Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. To celebrate Paul McCartney's 80th birthday, over four episodes I'll be speaking to a potpourri of delicious guests who'll be choosing their favourite Fab Macca song. We'll also be hearing from lots of Egg Pod listeners who've picked a song that means the most to them. So, let's get part one underway. Take it away, Egg Podders.
I'm Terry Westgate, and I've loved Paul McCartney since I was about six. In the house I grew up in, the closest thing we had to religion was the Beatles. Macca was topping the charts when I was young, and I loved the Frog Chorus and Pipes of Peace. But watching Yellow Submarine for the first time was a magical moment in my childhood. And that film ends with a gloriously uplifting Paul song, All Together Now.
One, two, three, four, can I have a little more? Five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
The title is even translated on screen into different languages. An inclusive gesture. Everyone is welcome. McCartney is so many things to so many people, but for me, his music is joyful. And this song, All Together Now, always makes me smile.
Boom, 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 boom. Sail the ship.
This is Matthew Diamond, and my choice is All Together Now. The song that plays out Yellow Submarine isn't by any stretch McCartney's finest moment or anyone's favourite, but in its kiddie nursery rhyme way, All Together Now is probably the perfect throwaway to end a cartoon about a group duffing up blue meanies. More to the point, it demonstrates the true genius of Paul McCartney, at the root of which lies his ability to conjure up songs out of nothing. The reason his detractors slag him off for granny shit like All Together Now or Heaven Help Us the Frog Chorus is precisely why he should be revered. Of course he could be subtle or profound, but it takes a unique talent to knock out a nothing song that's still an earworm 54 years later.
Sea moon, sea moon, sea moon, is she?
Hi, this is Bob Collins from Gillingham, Kent. I used to be in a band called The Dentist. The song I want to talk about is Sea Moon, the much derided Sea Moon. I was five when the Beatles split up. I have no memory of them being together, but one of my first solo contemporary Beatles memories is Sea Moon. I loved that song. The line in particular, how come no one older than me ever seems to understand the things I want to do, A, really spoke to me as a seven-year-old. I loved it. And B, even all these years later, the melody, the cadence, the tumbling down of those words, the simplicity of it is everything about what is simple and yet genius about Paul McCartney.
Hey Chris, it's Gail here. I'd have to say that my favourite Paul track is from his Band on the Run album from 1973, and it's of course 1985. So I first heard this song last year, would you believe, and it actually kick-started my deep dive into Paul's post-Beatles work. It's now my ringtone as well, and I have tried and failed to play it on the guitar many a time. It's such a tremendous song. It's just going from a simple piano ditty to this monster of a track with all the instruments coming to the fore. Paul sounds like he's just having such a good time singing it and playing it. It's just a brilliant song.
Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime? If you want me to, I will.
Sarah Louise Green, talking about I Will from the White Album, which is seemingly a kind of standard Paul love song, achingly wistful and melancholic and quite sparse, not a huge amount of orchestration. He plays the bass line with his mouth, which is extraordinary. But it's not really until you get to the end of the song that you realise that he is talking about a love that he's not even met yet. And it becomes this existential exploration into what is love, which I think kind of sums Paul up, really. He's a lot deeper than he sometimes appears, I think, in his songwriting.
Comedy writer, author and musician Jason Hazley, you've picked a song from the White Album.
I have. Now, listen, what happened is you sent me an email saying, will you come on Egg Pod and talk about one Paul McCartney song? And I replied, yes, I will. I know, it's not that funny. It just struck me as... Because actually, the thing is, I think I replied within about 30 seconds because yeah. I went, there's only one song I want to talk about of his, because I Will is just... I will argue that it's the best melody. It's the finest melody of any Beatles song, I think. It's just... It's like the Citroën Dais and the Shawshank Redemption. It is touching perfection. It's absolutely extraordinary. So, that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about I Will. But before I do that, Chris, I need to pick a bone with you.
Mm.
Back in late February 2020, you and I recorded an episode of this where I talked about the album Get Back. And you know what? It's a real kick in the confidence nuts that you've since had about 1,000 other people on to talk about that album.
Sorry about that. You were the first.
Yeah, there we go.
Then it was just ahead of my time. It was a pipe dream then, wasn't it?
It was a dream, wasn't it? Oh. It was a dream. But do you know what? There was a... I think both you and I, and I bet a lot of Beatles fans actually, are absolutely confident that it was going to come out. In the same way that now, I'm absolutely confident that one day they're going to release all the multi-tracks so you can just basically roll your own Beatles mixes, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sure that's going to happen. It's such a logical thing to do.
Some sort of streaming service, I reckon.
Yeah. David Bowie did it, didn't he? He released all the multis for Space Oddity, I think.
Yeah, he did. He had a competition a few years ago, didn't he, where you could mash up his songs from one of his albums. Can't remember. Heathen, I think.
Gosh, oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of Bowie.
Enough of Bowie.
And I love the lineup on this, before we talk about anything else. Most people, everybody will know this is from the White Album. And we can hear a lot of this on the anthology on the
album. Yes. John is playing temple blocks, which are an Asian instrument, which look like heads with mouths open, which is why at some point on the sessions you can hear him go, hit them skulls. And I think the maracas are an overdub by Paul, and Ringo is just playing a very small kit. He's playing the cymbal very lightly. He's playing on the rim of the snare drum, with the heel of the hand down, damped on the skin, and the tip of the stick hitting the rim. And there's a little bit of bass drum in there. It's very indistinct, but you hear it best as you go into the second verse. So it's a tiny little arrangement, and the only things that went on afterwards were McCartney put some backing vocals on the day after. This was recorded on the 16th of September 68, I think.
Yes.
And the day after, McCartney overdubbed maracas, backing vocals, and his 12-string guitar.
Mm.
He and John both got 12-string guitars in 1964, and John immediately put his to use on things like Hey, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away and Help and things, and McCartney held back a little bit with his, I think. It's got a brilliant name. I wrote it down because I didn't know what this make of guitar was, but because normally you just think of guitars with sort of, not, you know, straightforward names. Oh, it's a Gibson, or this is a 335, this is a D28, it's a Martin or whatever. No, this 12-string is called a Framus Hootenanny. I looked it up, and they're just very ordinary-looking guitars, but with an incredibly dizzy name.
Yeah. I love when I first got the anthology, hearing all the outtakes from this, and all these things they're doing, like Stepping Aside, Love, and that kind of thing. You can hear it's the same lineup. I always thought, back in the day, it was just Paul playing all the instruments, and it was so nice to hear John and Ringo doing a very kind of subservient role, just backing Paul.
Yeah, and also, and this brings us back to Get Back, enjoying themselves. You know, there's a nice moment on the big White Album box set that came out. There's a few outtakes on there, and there's a nice one where they just collapse into silly voices saying, well, this won't do, will it, chaps? You know, and they're obviously just having a lovely time, you know, which is... That was the biggest takeaway from Peter Jackson's films, were these guys really loved each other and enjoyed doing what they did. And this is a very good example. But even though what you've actually got here is a very simple and just brilliantly constructed song. So melodically, here's where I get boring. It is mainly made of thirds, which are just expressing, they're sort of chords that have been scattered, basically. So, da-da-da-da-da, that's the F major chord, and then da-da-da, that's the top three quarters of a C7 chord, and then da-da-da-da-da, and then we go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which is a B-flat chord coming down, then a turnaround on an F chord. Sounds a bit like church bells, that bit, I was thinking. That sort of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da that you get, you know, that peel?
Yeah.
And it's all thirds, so it's all kind of intervals that like each other, and there's so many lovely little symmetries in it as well. Things go up and come down on thirds, they climb little ladders and then come down different ladders, and also the lovely symmetry of the first two notes, who knows, are the same as I will, so it begins, yes, where it ends. It's just it's full of these little internal symmetries. It's a really beautiful bit of writing, and it's a lovely vocal as well. It's one of those vocals where you kind of think, I was reading, I thought I'll go and have a look at the recording history, and it's slightly disingenuous, the recording history, because there were 67 takes of it. The one that they used, I think, is take 65, but only 19 of those takes were actually complete. The rest were all full starts, messing around, singing Step Inside Love, doing Los Paranoias.
Los Paranoias invite you to just enjoy us. Come on, you can do it, baby. Come on and join Los Paranoias.
Which is great. Just that reminded me, by the way, anybody who's bored and has got 10 minutes to spare, go and look up Joe Meek's Wikipedia entry, because the acts he had in there, you know, he had the names got more and more ludicrous, you know, Jimmy Miller and the Barbecues, Malcolm and the Countdowns, and my favourite one, which was, this is so funny, Alan Dean and his problems. Which is up there with Joel Pereira and the Pereira brothers, yeah, isn't it, you know?
Wallflowers.
Oh, and the other overdub, of course, which is and this is the one time they did this, is Paul McCartney dum-dums at a bass line.
Yeah.
Which is a cracking idea. I don't know where he came up with that, but it's just beautiful. It works very well. There's two anomalies here, right? One is on the mono version, it doesn't come in till the second verse, and on the stereo, it's in from the very front. The other one is that normally he starts on a low F, which is dum. I think it's there. I haven't got perfect pitch, but I think it's around there. And then he goes down to a low D. And the rest of the time he goes up to a D, but he goes down, the second note is down to a low D. And I don't believe he can have done that. So I wonder whether it was very speeded.
Could be.
Because it's such a low note. It's really out of most men's register. And I think it's out of his register.
Yeah.
So there you go. If I do get my two questions with Paul McCartney, that'll be question two.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the mono version, because that changes the whole structure of the song. Because it's literally just Paul and guitar, I think, for the first section. It's very subtle. And then it builds in with the bass. And
it's the most different mix I know between mono and stereo, I think, of any Beatles songs, because it's very rare that they kind of pull things out for one mix and put them back in for another one. I know there's a couple of examples of that in like single mixes and things, and there's the peculiar anomaly of the re-release, the box set Sgt. Pepper, Getting Better on there has got a different take of the bass line than the one that's been on any of the previous releases, which is odd. But it's a very different song. The mono one as well, it sort of emphasises the delicacy of the whole thing as well, because once it's all squashed together, that really gentle percussion is so far back that it's almost imperceptible.
Mm.
Yeah, it is. It's a perfect miniature, this song, and it's got all sorts of lovely nods in it, I think. He was on the recordings, they're talking about it being like Latin, aren't they? And you can kind of hear, the only place you can really hear that is Ringo's rims, where he's kind of going da 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 cha cha cha. Basically, yeah, he's doing a little cha 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 in there, but the backing vocals as well, and slightly the melody as well, makes me think it feels like that's got a quite. I think that's weighted by the Everly Brothers. I can really hear some Don and Phil going on in those backing vocals. What did you think?
Yeah, it's not really like anything else they ever did. And it's veering more into solo Paul. I can hear it'd fit nicely on something like Ram or Wildlife, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of them really were kind of turning into 70s Beatles around this time for me. Beautiful. And I love the ending. You know musical terms better than me, so you can tell me where he changes. I will. Goes to a different chord before it goes to the final. I will.
Yes, he basically takes the root note, the F. The whole song's in F, and then he flips it so that underneath he plays a D flat chord, so that suddenly the I will is now the third of a chord. So you get that lovely little kind of tantalising chord change for a couple of bars at the end before he goes into the final little da 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 da. Oh damn, it's beautiful. It's such a beautiful song. I was trying to work out, is this song about Jane Asher? Is it about Linda, who I think he met between writing the song and writing the lyric? Or is it just a song about being in love? And I get the feeling it's just a song about love.
Yeah, well,
in his lyrics book, he says it's not really about anyone in particular, but then he's not... That lyrics book is those observations of his are not... They're not 100% secure, I think, are they?
No. He originally started writing the tune in India with your friend and mine, Donovan.
Oh, Donovan, yeah. So Donovan was there for some of this, and Donovan probably wrote some of the original lyric, which was so disappointing.
Well, he said he came back and he said he didn't like the lyrics that he'd had because I think it was stuff about moons. And then he did read.
Paul McCartney can't have resorted to Moon and June, surely. Surely not. That would be like Stravinsky going, I'll just do a 12-bar blues, it'll be fine. You know? That's insane. Moon and June.
Yeah, and he came back when he came back after India. Yeah, he finished it then. So yeah, he might be on the verge, but he's written so many. We've talked about it a lot recently, actually, about his love songs. You know, every other song is a love song. So I don't think he's going to remember who he wrote it for.
No, that's true. He's done. There's some nice little tricks in this song as well. Like even again, this is all. I'm sorry, this is technical because I mean I love the song. I could just sit here and say I love this song. This is a lovely song. I could just do that, but that's probably even more boring than how boring I'm being. There's little things like there's half bars in there, so it's mainly in four, but occasionally he slips in a two just to keep you going.
Yeah,
and you can kind of hear Ringo enjoying the fact that. Now he could also confuse people, you know, and just have a bit of fun with where's the three's gone. We're back to one, are we? And there's also I like the bit at the end where he plays with the rhyme, and he so seldom does this. He's not a particularly playful lyricist. He's a very kind of he's a workmanlike lyricist, but occasionally he does do something where he has a bit of fun and he plays with the rhyme at the end. Play it loud so I can hear you. Play it loud so I can hear you. For the things you do, endear you to me. So for the end of the line, the ear you rhyme, but it's not the end of the line. He keeps going. He adds another few words on there, which is great. I can't think of many examples when he is kind of really genuinely playful with his lyrics like that. I think the best one is the one that everybody misquotes, which is, and if this ever-changing world in which we're living, you know, which I'm sure he wrote going, I know how difficult this is going to be for people. They're going to go, what's he doing? I'm sure he knew what he was doing there. That does feel very much like a man who knows what he's doing.
So, Jason Hazley, what does this song mean to you?
It kind of boils down a lot of what being Paul McCartney at that time was about, I think, and also by extension what being a Beatle was about. Now Parche George is not on this, but let's say his spirit's in the room. What I like about this is there, apart from the fact that it's melodically just brilliant, it's such a brilliant melody, I'll stop saying that now, is it does two things. Number one, it comes from an album. Well, there was an album in 1967 called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and it was followed by an album called The Beatles, which is really them going, okay, now this is us. So we're not going to be pretending we're those people anymore. This is us. So it is coming from the heart, and it's coming with a real candor. And the message of the song, I Will, is basically just yes. And it reminds me of, you know, the great big, there's a big yes, isn't there, in Yellow Submarine, the film. There's a huge yes, and there's big realizations of words like love and yes. And this is just a great big yes. Saying I will is saying yes. And it's like, it's that. So it's them at their most Beatle and Paul at his most Paul saying yes. And I can't think of a more positive combination of things than that, really. Can you?
I've got to say no, haven't I? No.
You don't have to. You could say, yes, I've thought of a better one.
So, Paul McCartney at 80, why do you think his music has endured for all these years?
Well, I suppose for two reasons. One is because he is so very good at what he does. And the other one is that he has never stopped doing it. And again, to go back to the Peter Jackson films, to watch this one guy driving so hard, not necessarily, I mean, sometimes he's pushing his bandmates, but otherwise he is just like, he cannot stop having ideas, you know? And that's still the case now, in his 80th year. He still probably sneezes and a song comes out, you know? I mean, he's an extraordinary engine of a man, he really is, and a brilliant creator. I mean, and there are people who, you know, there are people who do things very slowly and there are people who do things very quickly. And he just seems to have a constant tap flowing of stuff. And right around this time, around 67 to 69, really, he was kind of, he was at his really a genuine creative peak. I was going to say his creative peak, but I'm not sure he had one. I think he may have had more than one peak. But this is definitely one of them. He really is absolutely at the top of his game at this point. And his voice is just gorgeous as well at this point. There's something, you know how John didn't like his voice very much and was always kind of throwing it through Leslie's and all sorts of other nonsense like that. Paul is like, this is just Paul's voice. You know, it's the same as it is on something like Blackbird. It's just a very direct, this is from me to you. This is from Paul to you, the listener. And it's and I'm saying, I will, yes. So this is me, Paul, saying yes. That'll do, won't it?
Jason Hazley, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Hello to everybody at the Egg Pod. My name is Danny, and the song that I'm selecting, the Paul McCartney song, is Flying to My Home. It's the B-side of the My Brave Face cassette single, if you can imagine such a thing. And I heard it when I was about 7 or 8, and it would always, my dad had that cassette single in the car, and it would always keep automatically flipping over in our tape machine in the car and play those two songs over and over again. And while My Brave Face sounded like really grown up, it was obviously about a couple having issues, and at 8 years old it didn't make an awful lot of sense to me. I just loved this song, Flying to My Home. I liked that he was singing it in kind of a silly voice, and it was a nice catchy rock and roll song, and I'm not making a case for it being brilliant, but I did love it. And that's my suggestion. Thanks very much, love the show.
It's maybe not the most obvious choice, but it's time we talked about Flying to My Home, the B-side to the first McCartney single I ever bought at 17. In many ways, it's pure McCartney. Harmonies? Check. The a cappella opening is gorgeous, but the final home, then bleeding into the dearly beloved notes of an organ. Then, hey, left turn into a perfect little pop song. Silly voice, catchy chorus, great guitar work, and a middle eight that just chugs along. And underpinning it all is the core McCartney message, home. It's where my love is living. And I'm going there, and I'm not just going, but I'm flying with all the speed and the lightness that implies. Home. All that in 4 minutes, that only feel like two. Happy birthday, Paul. Thanks for all the presents.
Your day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you.
A song of Paul's I really love is For No One, because beneath its beautiful vocals and gorgeous melody, I love its lyrics. It plays about with this grief-stricken perspective. You feel shattered, but she feels nothing. But even still, it's more interesting than that, because with grief comes this distorted sense of what actually happened. Was she in love then, and how does she feel now? For No One has this incredible economy of language because of the way it's told you. You really feel it. You are thrown back into a familiar state of heartbreak, being homebound with an aching head. And with that comes fragments of very real, yet very abstract conversations. Every line is obtuse, but it's still loaded enough to connect with it. Paul can strike this balance between the vague and the specific. He has so many gifts, and I love that he can express what hope can come with loss.
Hello, Chris. This is Adam and Heather from RetroTube Archive Television Podcast, your Get Back Day 12 correspondents.
Hello.
Much as I love Paul's playful rockers like Monkberry Moon Delight, Spin It On or Queenie Eye, I think nobody in the world has ever had quite the gift for melody as Paul McCartney. Not just catchy tunes, but tunes that already feel like standards the first time you hear them. And I particularly love his anthems. So I'm going to pick, as my ultimate Paul McCartney song, Wanderlust from Tug of War. Who else could make a song about a drug bust sound so euphoric and beautiful, and almost like a hymn? For me, it's up there with anything he did with the Beatles. It'd fit right in on Abbey Road, I reckon. French horns, counter melody, George Martin, Ringo Starr, it's got everything. Also, an honorary mention for the severely underrated However Absurd. Honestly, what an amazing song. How about you, Heather?
Well, you know how much I love Paul McCartney. So it was very difficult for me to pick a song that I like best by him. But after an awful lot of consideration, I've kind of narrowed it down to two. I am kind of torn between For No One, which is Paul McCartney, potentially his most misanthropic. You know how I love a bit of generalised misanthropy. But I think potentially my favourite is I've Just Seen a Face from Help. Because I think I may be the only person in the world who really loves the Help album.
Hi, my name is Claire Shenton. I've been a Beatles fan since I was 12 years old with the release of the Marvellous Anthology series, and the song I'm choosing for today is I've Just Seen a Face. The more I listen to and read about Paul McCartney, the more the realisation hits that we're so lucky to live at the same time as the greatest ever musical composer. It's hard to pick a song that means the most to me, as there's a song for every emotion, life event, and frankly my favourite Paul song probably changes day to day anyway. But one thing's clear to me, his upbringing was such a powerful influence on him. One of the most powerful elements of Paul's songwriting is the melody. And even when stripping back production, it gives a quality that allows his songs to go down well at a sing-song, much like he would have enjoyed with his family growing up. Sing-songs were a fundamental part of my upbringing too at precious family get-togethers. And one song that always got everyone clapping their hands, stomping their feet and singing along and attempting harmonies was I've Just Seen a Face, which is pretty impressive for an album track.
Next we have broadcaster and presenter Rachel Burden. So what song have you picked?
Well, I mean, I can imagine for everyone that you've asked to do this, it's just a case of where on earth do I start? So I almost put a kind of pin in the songs that jumped out at me as soon as I thought about iconic Paul McCartney songs and just went, that one. So I've chosen I've Just Seen a Face from the album Help.
Falling, yes I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again.
Why this one?
So I think this song is just a perfect piece of pure joy. Do you know what? I don't know that much about the history of the song. I like to think it's from Paul's own personal experience. In my head, he's talking about Jane Asher. He's totally in love with her. And it's got a kind of just a visceral joy to it that I find utterly infectious. And the whole way it's written is with this breathless excitement. Like, you know, we've all had those moments in our lives where it's just like, I've got to just tell you about this person. I've just met them. They're amazing. I don't know where it's going to go, but I'm so excited about it. And when I listen to it, that's what I hear. And he sounds so young. Because I think when we think about the Beatles, because of their incredible talent and phenomenal development as musicians over such a short space of time, we always forget how young they really were. And he just sounds really young and fresh and excited and, you know, living the life in mid-60s London, happy relationship. He was living with her at the time, I think. You know, the Beatles absolutely sort of at their, I suppose, commercial and peak of fame. And I cannot help but smile and sing along when I hear this song.
Yeah. As you say, yeah, he was living with Jane's parents at the time, 57 Wimpole Street in London, which at the time was very progressive, of Jane's parents especially.
Yeah, no, completely. I wonder how I'd feel if my daughter said, oh, my musician boyfriend's going to move in with me. I mean, I suppose if it was a Beatle, that would probably be acceptable. But it's funny, it's because I don't Chris, I don't have your gargantuan memory bank when it comes to all the detail about Beatles songs. I did a quick refresher and I sort of looked back through a bit of history of it, and I referred back to the Bible, and I went back to the Complete Beatles recordings, to the Mark Lewisohn book. And it's so funny, yeah, because the day he recorded this, right, he also recorded Yesterday. So the entire entry is about Yesterday. And literally right at the end, there's a line saying, oh, and you also did this other song in six takes. And it was mostly acoustic. And that's it. That's all the description we get from Lewisohn on it. But it's got that, I mean, it's got so many elements, hasn't it, of the kind of Paul the chameleon musician in it, and picking influences from all over the place. But it, obviously this one's got that really strong sort of country bluegrass feel. But I also hear the kind of Celtic influence, understandably, in all of that as well. And yeah, I love it.
As you say, yeah, 14th of June 1965. So the session was from 2:30 till 5:30. I've Just Seen a Face. Then I'm Down of all the other songs. And then 7 p.m. Just Yesterday. Throw that one, you know.
Yeah.
Quickly do that. Yeah.
But apparently it was a period in the Beatles where John had been really productive and had been responsible for writing quite a lot of the singles that they put out within the previous 6 months or whatever period it was. And according to one version of history, Paul felt a sort of certain pressure or need to, you know, just to get back writing again. I think he'd been distracted by 60s London when I suppose all the rest of them were doing, you know, married life and stuff. And And so this was one of those songs. And you can imagine him literally just going plinky plinky plonk and doing it in about 5 minutes flat. But it's no less brilliant, you know, for the fact that it was probably written off on the back of a fag packet.
Because the confidence to go in the studio and do those three songs, because looking at the dates, so Monday the 14th of June, on Saturday the 12th of June, it had been officially announced that they'd been awarded the MBE. So they must have. He must have been feeling on top of the world. You know, he's living with. I was just going to say about it, back to Wimpole Street, because Jane's mum, Margaret, was a music teacher, and Richard Asher was a senior physician at Central Middlesex Hospital, and he's famous for his 1951 article in The Lancet in which he described and named Munchausen syndrome. So there's a lot of wealth, and, you know, he's going to theatre. Jane's brother, Peter and Gordon fame, was living there as well. But also I love the fact that it was Margaret Asher who taught Paul to play the recorder, which we'd obviously later hear on Fall on the Hill. But in that studio, there's a lovely bit in Barry Miles' Many Years From Now about the music room where Paul wrote this. And as well as this song, in that music room he wrote, I Want to Hold Your Hand and I Love Her. Every Little Thing was written in there. Eleanor Rigby. But Barry Miles' description of the room, so you can picture where he was when he wrote it. And he says, the room had a low ceiling, wooden cupboards with grass fronts along one wall, and was cluttered with metal music stands and old music scores. The small windows opened into the area below the front railings. And it's very evocative. You can picture John and Paul in there doing the eyeball-to-eyeball thing in this antiquated
room.
Just
imagine the music memories within those walls, though, as well. My goodness. If the music created left some kind of physical imprint, you'd want to go and unpeel the wallpaper, wouldn't you, and see what was there. Amazing. And by the way, because it's one of those songs I love to sing at top volume, which my family clearly hates, but I've also tried to sing it as a lullaby. So I've also slowed it down to sing to my small children at night. And let me tell you now, it doesn't work. Okay, so don't try this at home. That might just be my voice, but you can't sing, I've just seen a face. It doesn't. Well, I mean, maybe someone could get away with it and jazz it up a bit, but you have to sing
good.
It like this. Wait till I tell you. I've just seen this person. It's just amazing. And I have to tell you all about her. It's the only way it works for me.
I love that also because the fact that it was originally called Auntie Gin's theme because she loved the song. But then you think, well, of course, he's going around his family's house and say, oh, have a listen to this song. And I love the idea of that going, you know, Auntie Betty or whatever, and playing all these songs to them.
So it was definitely tune first, wasn't it? Tune first, words later.
Yeah. But there's so much in this song as well, because you've got that beautiful finger-picking intro, which we'd not really heard anything like that before.
Help is such an interesting album, isn't it? Because, I mean, let's face it, they all are, right? But it really is, and I suppose you could say this about all of them, but you really do feel like it's that transitional phase. There is so much going on there. It feels like they are absolutely teetering from one kind of era to another, which is what they did within the space of 12 months, incredibly.
Yeah. And I love that Paul's harmonising with himself, because there's no way John would have been able to reach that.
Not
those
notes.
It's incredible, that harmony.
Yeah, but it is so perfect as well. I think it's another reason I like it. It is one of those. It's a very Paul song. It's Paul singing, you know, it feels like it's he's singing about himself, to himself, with himself, you know. And I don't know how much of the track he recorded himself, because I think there were various acoustic tracks laid down. I don't know how much of that was just him or him and George or what. I don't know if you got the detail of that, but it feels like a bit like the Ballad of John and Yoko. It's almost one of those that two of them could have gone in and just knocked off in half an hour.
Yeah. It's kind of like, reminds me of Two of Us in that respect.
Yes.
It's, you know, with the harmonies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But no, it's all of them. They're all playing acoustic guitar, but Ringo's on brushed
right.
snare drum. So it's a full band thing.
Which so they're all on it.
Yeah. And I love the fact that it's like Yesterday, I guess. It's hidden away on this UK soundtrack album, effectively. You know, it's on the side two, hidden
away. Well,
because
it didn't make it into the film, did it? I think he recorded it after the film had been made. So although it's on the soundtrack, it's not in the film.
But it was recorded a couple of days after they were watching the first rushes of the film. They're actually at Twickenham. The Beatles at Twickenham again, we've been talking about quite a bit.
Well, yeah, which we are so much more familiar with now.
Yes, yeah. And the disparities from the UK and the US releases, because like I say, this was hidden away really on the B-side, but it was 6 months after we heard it over here, in the US, it was the opener of Rubber Soul, where they sort of bastardised all the tracks.
Was it? Yeah.
So it's a key moment. And what they did, they took it, you know how they butchered all the albums.
Yeah.
They took off Drive My Car, Nowhere Man, What Goes On, and If I Needed Someone, and replaced them with I've Just Seen a Face, which started it, and It's Only Love. So in doing so, they've inadvertently created an almost entirely acoustic folk album.
Yeah.
Which it's an interesting listen.
Presumably because they thought it would be more palatable to US audiences?
I think it was more a case of just see how many albums we can get out of this band and just filter it. But oddly enough, this version, some believe that it's this version that Brian Wilson heard, which inspired him to do Pet Sounds, which then inspired the Beatles to do Sgt. Pepper.
Pepper. Oh, that's interesting.
An important song.
It's a really important song. I didn't realise quite how important it was. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that is, in terms of the kind of dynamic from artist to artist at that time, that is absolutely fascinating. And how even just mixing up songs in a different way creates some kind of chemical reaction in another musician that leads them to create something else quite spectacular. It's really curious, isn't it?
Yeah. Can you remember when you first heard this song?
Well, I think it was quite early on in my Beatles journey, because I was very much a kind of 13-year-old fan, and I, you know, I loved all the early music and kind of consumed that rapaciously in the kind of first year of me discovering the Beatles. And I think because Paul was the object of my lust, I think I probably imagined he was singing it to me. So, you know, for that reason, it really spoke to me.
So, Rachel Byrne, Paul McCartney at 80, why do you think his music has endured for all these years?
I think he has this, it's a kind of ability to pluck a tune out that you cannot scientifically explain. And I think his brain sees or hears music in the landscape that the rest of us don't, right? And maybe this is true of all musicians. And he has this just enormous capacity to create and live his life
through music. And I think he has always wanted to learn and absorb from other musicians and different styles. And I think it's what makes him live and breathe. And I don't think you can do that just churning out the same old stuff. You're always wanting to. You've got a hunger to experience new music, incorporate that into your own. Obviously, there was the unique alchemy that he had with John and the rest of the Beatles. But he's just, and I used the word chameleon earlier, you know, chameleon is probably the wrong word, because it's not like he goes into the background, but he can just insert himself almost into any sort of artistical musical era and adopt its clothing, but out of that bring a completely fresh sound. And I just think he's phenomenal. Also, I think he's probably looked after himself quite well, you know. It helps having a team of daughters keeping you in line, I like to think. Keeping your head in the right space.
Definitely. Rachel Burden, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for asking me, Chris.
Hi Chris and EggPod listeners, it's Rob Manuel here. You know, it's impossible to have just one best Paul McCartney song, but here's five reasons why Too Many People is one of my favourites. One, it opens one of my favourite albums, Ram. Just hear those opening bars, and now we've got 40 minutes of greatness ahead. Two, I love the line, Too Many People Paying Parking Fines, where he dobs in John for just dumping his car anywhere and letting the Apple office sort out the fines. Nice one, Paul. Three, it's that the mono mix is blistering and bassy. It's worth checking out. It's a direct line from my favourite Beatles album, The Mono Rubber Soul. Man, turn it up loud. Four, you took your lucky break and broke it in two. What an amazing line that rings true for any of us that have once been part of a creative partnership. And it's all gone a bit Pete Tong. Five, but it's just melodically so damn good. Happy birthday, Paul. Here's to the next 80 years as you get cryogenically frozen into a AI machine and continue producing Beatles greats into the future. Open up your heart if you wanna set me free. Full of love, your love. Sailing on a wide, dark, open sea. Sailing on a wide, dark, open sea.
Hello, this is Paul from the Big Beatles Sort Out and the Head Ballet podcast with my McCartney moment, and it's from the Not Talked About Enough 1993 album, Off the Ground. The song is Wine Dark Open Sea. I was already a Beatles fan when this came out, but between Flowers in the Dirt, which was the first tape I bought with my own pocket money, and Off the Ground, I became a confirmed fan of Paul's as a solo artist as well. Also, because I was and still am a soppy, heart-on-the-sleeve sort of chap, songs with a sweet, simple groove and messages about loving someone and feeling loved have always really appealed to me, and certainly did to me as a romantic 15-year-old back then. I got the sheet music back at the time, and I still sometimes dig it out and sit and play Wine Dark Open Sea. I love it.
Hi, I'm Karen from the Netherlands. Because it's impossible to choose a favourite Paul song, I picked the one that started it all for me when I was 11 years old, Mull of Kintyre. I must have heard the song on the radio before, but I distinctly remember watching the video for the first time on Dutch pop show Top Hop, and my dad telling me, "He's one of the Beatles, you know," followed by, "He's the only one of them who's still normal." It still makes me smile when I think about that. Anyway, the next day I took my pocket money and went to buy the single, my very first one, and the rest is history.
My brave, my brave.
Greetings, EggPod listeners. This is Thomas, and my pick of Paul McCartney's song is My Brave Face. Why? Because it's Elvis Costello forcing Paul to be Beatle Paul and guiding him to get the Hof now and use it on the track. And musically, it's very McCartney, very peppy and sounding optimistic. But lyrically, it's very Elvis Costello, very angsty and moody with lines like, ever since you went away, I've had the sentimental inclination not to change a single thing. Very wordy, which is probably a reason why Paul hasn't performed it in the last 20 years or so. But I love their songwriting collaborations, and this song is the jewel in the crown.
Hi, my name is Charlotte, and the song that I've chosen is She's Leaving Home. A 24-year-old Paul McCartney opens the paper and reads about a young girl who has gone missing. He then writes a song about love, about loss, about family, and about the differing perspective of the younger and older generation. And you have the beautiful arrangement by Mike Leander and the beautiful Lennon-McCartney harmonies that we all know and love. I love imagining them recording this eyeball to eyeball, just like they did in the old days. For me, the most underrated Beatles song. Never fails to take my breath away. And Paul did that at 24 years old. Amazing.
Film director and screenwriter Ben Wheatley, you've chosen a song from Sergeant Pepper.
I have. She's Leaving Home. It's, apart from the fact that it's a song that can make me from quite a good mood within about 30 seconds feel like crying. So that's like one of the main things I think about that song. It's so sad. And it's like, I think it's from hearing it as a kid and hearing it repeatedly through my life. It's always, even as a little kid, I thought it was the saddest thing I'd ever heard. And it's so atmospheric, and it just puts you in the moment. And I always think about like the sound of like wood pigeons or something, or that kind of dark grey light at that time in the morning, and her creeping about, packing her stuff and ready to go. And I think, you know, as a kid, it really brought it home, because there was like this idea, it was an option, wasn't it? It was one of the things that could happen, you know. And you're like, when you're like 9, 10, 11, you think, oh, is that how you leave home? Run off like that in the middle of the night with the bloke from the motor trade? Or is it, it was just mysteries of adulthood, wasn't it? You know, and yeah. Kind of. And that really seemed to be, it was very vivid, that song for me.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more.
It's interesting that you picked it, because it is lyrically and musically, actually, very cinematic.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a weird one as well, isn't it? We've talked about Sgt. Pepper's before, and I think that something I didn't realise about the song, like there's lots of songs in Sgt. Pepper's that are based on newspapers or cut-ups or Burroughsian Geisen-style cut-ups, and I didn't realise this was one as well until I did a paltry bit of research before doing this talk.
Thank you. Well, it was the 27th of February 1967 edition of the Daily Mail. Oh, still can't get over the Beatles read the mail, but anyway. And
I read that as well, and I thought, I like to think he was looking at a kind of fanned out in front of him were all the newspapers of the day.
Yes. he just took it for the crossword.
Yeah, he was just interested in all points of view. As his song is.
Yeah. I did a Twitter poll a few years ago, and the question was, where do your sympathies lie, with the parents or with the daughter? And it was like 50, literally 50-50, and he'd reached both generations with that one song.
I watched the thing about someone talking about The Graduate, and how The Graduate, when you watch The Graduate, your perspective changes as you get older. And at the beginning of it, you're with Benjamin, and when you have children, you hate Benjamin because he's a git.
I felt the same with Quadrophenia. I watched it recently. And I thought, get a bloody job.
Yeah, I was the same with Bugsy Malone. I was like, why have his children got guns? Doesn't make any sense.
But it's very interesting, the story behind it. Obviously, they read the newspaper article. The girl in the newspaper was a 17-year-old called Melanie Cole.
Yes.
And oddly, their paths had crossed before.
In a miming contest.
Yeah. Which was quite surreal. And I think she was 14 at the time. And then it was either a year after or a couple of years after, she was taken on by Ready Steady Go as one of the regular dancers.
How crazy.
So, yeah, 1960s and all that.
No wonder she wanted to leave home.
Well, her story was that she was going to all the clubs in London, you know, doing the Austin Powers 1960s stuff. And she was saying, you know, her parents were never affectionate while she was doing all this. I mean, she ran away from home, dumped her car, checkbook and clothes.
Well, that's what I couldn't get. I mean, the car. She's 17 and she's got a car. I was like, wow,
Well, according to her, she also had two diamond rings, a mink coat, you know, so.
It's very different from my image of the song. You know, in the lyrics of the song, they're like, she packed her diamond rings and jumped in. You know, it's like, I'd have been less sympathetic to her, I think. And ran off with a croupier.
Yes, in Paddington.
Who previously had been in the motor trade. So there was a connection there.
We gave her most of our lives.
Is leaving.
Sacrificed most of our lives. We gave her everything money could.
But lyrically, astonishing lyrics. They did both work on them. John got some of the "We Never Thought for Ourselves." Apparently, Aunt Mimi used to say things like that to him, and he got the sort of parental side. But they are genuinely moving, and you feel for both of them. You feel for the parents. You feel for the daughter.
Yeah. Do you think that he wrote the song after she turned up or before she turned up? It's a dodgy old game, that, writing a song about someone who's gone missing.
Yeah.
Because it could have had a really dark ending, couldn't it? I don't know. Yeah, I guess you'd have probably shared. We'd have never have heard it.
Well, no. But it's the, you know, a day in the life. You get a feel for their lifestyles, just sort of, oh, grab the newspaper. Oh, I'll write a song about that. There's a lot of newspapers.
Yeah, literally. Well, not even that. He's saying, I got out of bed. You know, you get the whole story of how he got to the newspaper.
Yeah.
Blow by blow. You know, it's that's a song I love as well. I guess it must have been influenced by the Barrosian cut-up style, you know, that was going around. And it's kind of, it certainly makes for a very different kind of approach to songwriting from them on that one.
Yeah. Because Paul played William Burroughs' Eleanor Rigby. But that was the world he was living in, you know, is with the Ashes. And he was right at the heart of it. And this, I really believe this could have been a great 1960s movie.
Well, speaking of which, as part of my extensive research, I did listen to the Bee Gees version as well.
Oh, from the film.
Yeah, where they interpret it as robots.
Yes.
I wouldn't have made that leap. Myself, but it's pretty good once they stop. Well, I quite like it while they're robots, but then later they sing with their own human voices, and that's quite good.
They do, famously scored by Mike Leander, because George Martin wasn't available.
What was he, just down the pub or something, or missed the bus? Well,
he was producing Cilla Black at the time.
Oh, that's a double blow.
But Paul had literally phoned him up and said, right, can you do 2 o'clock tomorrow? He said, well, I've booked the studio. I've got everything done for 2:30. So Paul got Neil Aspinall to root around for someone to do a score for it. And yeah, Mike Leander did it quickly. So Paul turned up to George Martin and said, right, here's the score. And George, he was so upset. You know, he's been quoted as saying how upset he was. He did make a few changes, though. So there is a bit of George in there, which is nice.
Was it him that sped it up?
I wonder, yeah.
Speedgate. It's quite interesting, the whole Speedgate. I was trying to listen to the different versions, the mono version and the stereo version, to try and work out.
Because Giles Martin did it for the remix version, because he was editing everything as it would have been in mono. So he put it to the original speed.
Yeah, well, I'm assuming that's what they wanted it to have, that kind of slightly sharper, higher register across it. But it's interesting. It just says, speaks to their kind of experimentation, doesn't it, at the time of, like, I didn't even know about this, that they were kind of dicking with the sound, the speeds on a lot of the tracks. I mean, there's the more obvious stuff, but in general, kind of changing stuff around.
Yeah. So, what does this song mean to you?
I think it's just it has a connection directly to my childhood. So, and it's like the whole of Sgt. Pepper's does, you know. So immediately, I am transported back to the kind of late 70s whenever I listen to it, and so then that connects me to my parents and to growing up and all those things. And I think then later it kind of got cemented in my head when the 20th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's was quite a big thing, and we had to write essays on stuff at school. And I had to write, and I wrote my essay on this one. So that, again, I kind of like had to kind of go into it and write a rather juvenile essay, literal essay about what the lyrics meant. Which there's not much subtext to them, to be fair.
Well, no.
It's pretty straightforward explanation, but it's more like the kind of the emotional sense of them. I thought it was just all a bit sad. You know, it's not, like you say, it's kind of, I think there is a third way through this. It's like you're for the daughter, you're for the parents, or you're for the whole family. You just go, oh, Christ, there is no happy ending to this. And it sounds like when they found her, eventually dragged her out by her hair into a car and whisked her away. I read an interview with her.
I think that line, she breaks down and cries to her husband, "Daddy, our baby's gone." And you've got that dramatic violins going on. That's heart-wrenching.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I find the Beatles songs always quite emotional, but there's not stuff as dramatic as that, I suppose.
So, Ben Wheatley, Paul McCartney at 80, why do you think his music has endured for so long?
I think it's because they always had a taste for experimentation, and they were often ahead of their time, massively ahead of their time. So, as ever with this stuff, people were always catching up with it. It's not really enduring it. It doesn't really endure. It's more that it becomes new for each generation that hears it and is surprised by it. And I think there's a lot of different kind of ingredients inside it. I mean, there's a lot of emotion inside it, and there's a lot of humour inside it to be unpacked, along with the complicated musical arrangements and also the Beatles as a package itself. That it's such a great story as they develop over time. You know, you take each of the albums, it's very straightforwardly developing and getting, you know, they're finding their craft and they're reinventing music, pop music around them as they do it. And I think that is such, you know, a period which was, I guess, a lot less saturated or a lot less segmented than it is now. It's a much cleaner story to follow. You know, I think that's good. And yeah, and I think his later work as well, I loved. I mean, Temporary Secretary. Always got time for that. And Live and Let Die, I often play as I go on the train to work as a soundtrack.
Wow.
To pep it up a bit. It's either that or Money by Pink Floyd. Or Welcome to the Machine. I like that one if I hit Victoria.
Ben Wheatley, thank you so much.
Chris, thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you can come back for part two with lots more guests and lots more Macca favourites. Bye. Hey, hey, hey.